without further ado, let me invite Rob Scott up. Rob, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and why you've come along to give this talk today?
You invited me, so that's
the easy one reason. Okay. Well, Marcus invited me.
I work for a church in the city underneath the Gherkin, St. Helen's Bishopsgate, that way. But much of my work is focused on this kind of area of Tower Hamlets, helping Bangladeshi people, in particular, understand a little bit more about Jesus. And some of that is from our shop just off Brick Lane, and some of it is sometimes involved in a dialogue, not quite debates, but not kind of group hugs. We do disagree on stuff, but we do stuff in mosques and in churches together, looking at issues like this.
Great. And you spent some time in Bangladesh itself, is that right? Just tell us about that.
So a few years ago, me, my wife and three children, we spent 18 months in Bangladesh, in northeast Bangladesh. 95% of the Bangladeshis in this area come from a particular region called Sylhet, and they speak a slightly different dialect than the rest of Bangladesh. And so we went there to learn as much of their language here, so again, that we could communicate Jesus as best as possible we could with people here.
Great. Well, let me hand over to you, and I'll let you lead us through the session you put together for us.
Great. Thank you very much. You should have all got a handout just to follow along where we're going. We're starting on the inside there. Muhammad and Jesus, what's the difference and does it matter? Clearly, I'm biased. I follow Jesus. I want people to know about Jesus. I'm a Christian person. I'm biased. But bias doesn't necessarily prevent reliability. Evidence will show whether I've been reliable or not, whether my bias stands up or not. When Sir Alex Ferguson was manager of Manchester United, if he was to say Manchester United are the best team in England, sadly, he was right most of the time. He was clearly biased, but the evidence backed it up. Fortunately, if Jose should say that nowadays, he's wrong. His bias isn't proved by results. It's unreliable in that respect. So please do check out the references that I put down here. And when talking about Muhammad, I have only put Islamic references down, apart from one, which is still very positive towards Muhammad and Islam. At the top of your sheet there, you've got a couple of posters, copy-pasted off the internet. Those kind of cheesy, keep calm and you have keep calm and love Muhammad, S-A-W. That's the Arabic phrase for peace and blessings be upon him. And then the Christians, not to be outdone, keep calm and love Jesus more. Now, I don't want the next 20 minutes or so to be kind of competitive religious syndrome. My God is better than your God, a kind of playground type approach. I hope this won't be like that. But I think there's another danger that we can sometimes have is that we censor ourselves. We're involved in self-censoring because we fear what others might say about us, or we fear we might upset people, or that others overhearing might be offended. And so we don't speak truth to one another. And we should, whatever our background, whatever our religion or political or social views, we should be willing to talk and engage respectfully with one another without censoring ourselves and keeping quiet. Now, some people might say Muhammad and Jesus, well, they're just the same. They're just the same in peace. They both brought a message of peace. As-salamu alaykum, the Muslim greeting. It's the same greeting that Jesus gave on Resurrection Sunday in John's Gospel when he appeared to the disciples. He said, my peace be with you, peace be with you, the same phrase. So maybe they're just the same, these two guys, Muhammad and Jesus. They're just about peace. Others might say, no, that's absolute nonsense. There's a peaceful veneer. There's a lot of words about peace, but underneath the surface is violence. When I did this talk yesterday over in the Ideas Store, and one lady says, yeah, look at the Bosnian genocide that was done by Orthodox Christians against Muslim people. Or look at ISIS. You talk about peace, these religions, but actually underneath, there's full of violence. Others might say, so what? Who cares? Yeah, both these guys, both these religions are utterly irrelevant in our post-Brexit, pre-Trump, massive cuts, worries about autumn statement world. What on earth can these guys be of any use to us today? Well, there are some similarities. Both of these men talk about God a lot. They both claim to be prophets. They talk about sin and heaven and hell and holy books. There are similarities. But there are some important differences as well. One rabbi has said that it's in differences that we find knowledge. It's in contrast that we find understanding and wisdom. A very silly example. Bananas and tomatoes are both similar in they're both classified as fruit. But we know the difference between them. That we don't generally put tomatoes in a fruit salad. When we're trying to do a good dessert, we don't put tomatoes there. Knowing the difference between them is important. A silly example. But in a similar and much bigger way, knowing the contrast and differences between these two people is very, very important. And as I hope you'll see, it's relevant now and forever as well. So what do you think of Muhammad there? Again, all these references are just from Muslim sources. It's inevitably brief. In the 20 minutes I've got to cover these two characters from history, it's inevitably brief and selective. But I put my selections down here for you so you can see, and you can chase up the references if you want to. So the first reference there from a Muslim website. According to Islamic belief, the Prophet Muhammad was the last messenger of God. He, like all of God's prophets and messengers, such as Noah, Abraham, Moses, and Jesus, was only a human being. Christians came to the mistaken assumption that Muslims worship Muhammad by formulating an incorrect analogy. They worship Jesus, so they assumed Muslims worship Muhammad. This is one of the reasons they called Muslims by the incorrect name Muhammadans for so many years. So just because Christians worship Christ and are called Christians, don't call Muslims Muhammadans. They don't worship Muhammad. He's just a man. He's not a god in this website's words. One Oxford professor of Islamic studies in the 1960s, his kind of popularizing book on Islam was called Muhammadanism. And this website and most Muslim people you'd meet would say, no, that's wrong. Don't call us that. And that's backed up by some of Muhammad's earliest companions. The next quote down, narrated Umar. So he was the second caliph, the second leader of the Muslim community after Muhammad. And he's recorded as saying, about 150 years after that, in a book like this. And this is a summary of the hadith, the sayings and doings of Muhammad. I've got this one in Bangladesh, but if you go to any Islamic bookshop, you can get kind of a 9-volume version of this. And with lots of these sayings, from recorded by a guy called Bukhari, from about 150 years after Muhammad. And you have the quote here, I heard the Prophet saying, do not exaggerate in praising me as the Christians praise the Son of Mary, for I am only a slave. So call me the slave Allah and his apostle. He's just a man. He's just a slave, a servant of Allah, a servant of God and his messenger. That next quote down is from Abu Bakr, who is the first caliph, the first leader after Muhammad. And at Muhammad's death, he is recorded as saying this, whoever amongst you worship Muhammad, Muhammad is dead. But whoever worship Allah, Allah is alive and will never die. Allah said, Muhammad is no more than a messenger. Many were the messengers that passed away before him. That Allah said bit is a quote from the Quran, from Surah 3. Again, Muhammad's dead. You don't worship him. Worship God. And the Quran itself, Muhammad is said to say by God, say, I am but a man like yourselves. But the inspiration has come to me that your Allah is one Allah. Whoever expects to meet his Lord, let him work righteousness. And in the worship of his Lord, admit no one as partner. Muhammad is just a man like us, a human. But he has received inspiration, is what that says. He's received the Quran, revelation from God. That's what marks him out. And particularly this verse says that there's one God. None of this Trinity nonsense, you Christians, the Quran would often say. And as Muslim people, you're to work righteousness. That's the means by which you can enter paradise, by doing good things. And hope to receive God's mercy as you do so. So Muhammad is a man, and only a man, and he shouldn't be worshipped. But often, my Muslim friends, whilst they do not worship Muhammad in a kind of formal sense, I think they often do, within their hearts, put him on a pedestal. And here are some quotes, I think, which lead that way. One again from Bukhari, the collection of the hadith. None will have faith until he loves Muhammad more than his family and all humanity. Whatever we put in our hearts becomes our driving force, our reason for doing what we do, our goal in life. Little children, when they put their parents in their hearts, the most important thing, often, not always, will obey them and look up to them. And in some sense, worship them, do what they say. As we get a bit older, we put other things in our hearts that we kind of value above all things, that becomes our driving force. We may not call them our God, but it is our kind of ultimate being that we want to serve. And if Muhammad is supposed to be even more important than our parents, than our children, than our spouses, then it's not difficult to say how he might be put on a pedestal in some way. Next quote to the top of the other side of the page. If you obey Muhammad, then you're obeying Allah. And if you disobey him, then you are disobeying Allah. You can't put a cigarette paper between Muhammad and Allah. They're so close. And what they say is what the other says. Which all leads to Muhammad being the best example, the one that people are to emulate as the best person to follow. Yeah, the Quran says there in Surah 33 and 68. And then the non-Muslim website has this to conclude. Philosopher, orator, apostle, legislator, warrior, conqueror of ideas, restorer of rational dogmas, of a cult without images, the founder of 20 terrestrial empires and one spiritual empire. That is Muhammad. As regards all standards by which human greatness may be measured, we may ask, is there any greater man than he? Muhammad is like a great world leader, a great empire builder, Alexander the Great, or Napoleon, or a great statesman like Churchill, bringing people together for a common cause. But he's much more than that. He's founded a spiritual empire as well. But all of this, then, I think helps us to understand why cartoons that mock Muhammad might be offensive to our Muslim friends. If you hold something dear in your heart and it's mocked, you get upset. Again, think of our children in the playground. If their mum gets cussed, they get annoyed. How much more when someone is so important you hold on to and seem to be so special, do you get upset if they are mocked? Yet, this particular book is the earliest history of Muhammad. Again, available in most Islamic bookshops. And this says that he was unsure that he was hearing from God when he first kind of had an angel speak to him. He didn't know, is this God? Am I going mad? What's going on? At one stage within the Quran, he admits that he doesn't know what will happen to him or what will happen to his followers. The Quran is clear that he did no miracles apart from receiving the Quran. The Quran is said to be his miracle, but it's clear he did no others, says the Quran. And the Quran and the Hadith is clear that he sinned, that he did wrong, that he had to ask for forgiveness. That one Hadith says that he had to ask 70 times in one day. He wasn't perfect. And more soberly, he approved of mockers being killed. Again, in this book here, you have an example of where a female poet is speaking poetry against him. Poetry was kind of the cartoons of the day. And she spoke poetry against him. And he said, who would rid me of this woman? And someone did. And he approved of that murder. And that's in the Muslim source there. Muhammad was also involved in between 20 and 100 different skirmishes or battles. When I was talking about this talk with a Muslim friend who works in a madrasa in Bethnal Green, he put the figure at 27. He thinks there were 27 battles that Muhammad fought in. But numbers will vary. But the Quran is clear that unbelievers should be killed in certain circumstances. A hadith which explains and interprets that here, it says that that's a legitimate way of extending Islam. Again, in that the black book, The Life of Muhammad, it talks about a time when he is involved in different battles, and one Jewish tribe was fighting alongside him and then changed sides. But the Muslim people still won, and so they captured the Jewish tribe. And the punishment for the Jewish tribe, 600 to 900 men, the sources vary, the punishment for those men was to be beheaded and have their bodies thrown in a trench. It's not a short step from there to what's going on in Syria with ISIS. There's lots of things in between. There's Western foreign policy. There's hypocrisy. There's economics. There's deprivation. There's lines drawn in a desert by stupid British and French governments 100 years ago. But ISIS would claim to be doing what they are doing because of what they read in the history books there. This book, The Islamic Conquest of Syria, I got it from the Islamic bookshop outside East London Mosque in Whitechapel. I presumed it was all about ISIS, but it wasn't. It was about the first conquest of Syria by Muhammad's closest companions after he died. And what ISIS are doing is very similar to what happened back then. So what do you think of Muhammad? I'll leave that for you to think about and to follow up these sources. But at the very least, doing something like this is relevant for relationships now, for truthful relationships now, for going beyond mere tolerance, which often means I ignore you, to actually speaking the truth in love with people, understanding people better, and embracing them even where we disagree. None of this is an excuse to join Britain First and their pitiful demonstrations outside East London Mosque. They're shocking in their approach. But we should still be truthful about these things with one another and not want to hide them, but not leave it as an excuse for hate in any way. But do ask me about this later if you'd like to. But what do you think of Jesus? He was born of a virgin, proclaimed by angels. He resisted temptation, unlike anybody else. He proclaimed good news. He brought forgiveness. He was authenticated by miracles. What else helps to authenticate him is the way the Gospels are written. So Luke's Gospel, for example, Luke says, I'm writing this under the inspiration of God, having checked out the eyewitnesses, having talked to them. It's historically verifiable. Now, if that's something that you are more interested in, skeptical about, do take that little booklet away. Now, there's a load of different resources on the table there, and this is one of them. Why not read that if you'd like to? But Luke is saying he's writing verifiable history. Now, those first few things I said about Jesus there in Luke chapter 1 to 8, the same things that my Muslim friends would agree with. Most of those things are in the Quran in some way. But when you come to chapter 9 of Luke's Gospel, things really kind of go up a gear. My Muslim friends going to have a problem with that. Because the key issue is, who is Jesus? At the beginning of chapter 9, Jesus gives power to his disciples to go out and heal and drive out demons and preach. He gives out power. King Herod hears about this and says, who on earth is this guy? How can he do that? Is he a prophet come back from the dead? Is he Elijah? Is he John the Baptist? What's going on? So that's going on in the background of chapter 9 of Luke's Gospel. Who is Jesus? And Jesus understands that. And he asks that question himself, just at the bottom of that second side of the sheet for you. Now it happens that as he, that's Jesus, was praying alone, the disciples were with him. And he asked them, who do the crowd say that I am? And they answered, John the Baptist. But others say Elijah, and others that one of the prophets of old has risen. Then he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered, the Christ of God. Christ is a Greek word, Messiah is the Hebrew word, and they both mean in English, anointed one. And the Old Testament is looking forward to an anointed one who would be king. King David in 2 Samuel 7 is promised a son in his line who will rule and bring peace. He writes a psalm in Psalm chapter 2 that says, you need to seek refuge in this anointed one, this king, to be safe. As we come to Christmas time, we think of Isaiah chapter 9 and verse about a son being given who will rule righteously and justly. Well, that's a promise about this anointed one, 600 years before he was walking the earth. Jesus is this long-promised Christ, King, Messiah. Over the page, Jesus goes on, and he strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, the Son of Man must suffer many things, and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. Jesus, when he takes the title Son of Man, is taking an even bigger title, really, than Messiah or Christ or Anointed One. The prophet Daniel has a vision of one as a Son of Man who comes on the clouds of heaven to God and receives all authority and all power over all people for all times. He's like a global, eternal ruler, this Son of Man. But more than that, Daniel talks about Son of Man, who's also the Anointed One, suffering, being cut off. And as you're reading that, you're thinking, what does that mean? What's he going to be cut off for? And again, the prophet Isaiah helps us with that, where the prophet Isaiah says he is cut off for sins, but not his own. All the way through the Old Testament, God says that sins deserve to be punished. Jesus is the one that takes away those sins. He takes that punishment. So that's what he means when he says the Son of Man must suffer, die and rise again. He's saying, I'm going to die, just as Isaiah and Daniel look forward to be your rescuer, to bring you rescue and forgiveness from sins. But then he goes on. Now about 8 days after saying these things, he took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep. But when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it's good we're here. Let us make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. As he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him. And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they'd seen. Up on this mountain with Jesus is Moses, the great bringer of the law in the Old Testament. And there's Elijah, the great prophet who enforced the law. They're with Jesus, but by then they're not there. Only Jesus is left. They faded into the background. Jesus is greater than the law bringer and the law enforcer. In some ways, Muhammad in Mecca and Medina tries to be both. He tries to bring a law and enforce the law. But Jesus is greater than prophets that do that. Not least because, as it says on the sheet, he's God's son. And he knows where he's going. As son, he's greater than a prophet. Knows God far better to be able to explain him to us. And he knows where he's going. He says he's going on departure to Jerusalem. He knows he's going to die there and rise there and ascend there and bring forgiveness to all kinds of people. It's interesting that when you read the Quran, it cuts out both of those things about Jesus. It says he's not the son of God, and it says he didn't die. And so it leaves you with a truncated Jesus and no good news of forgiveness. And this voice from the cloud symbolizing God as it did throughout the Old Testament, where God shows his presence at Mount Sinai or in the tabernacle or in the temple. God speaks from the cloud, saying, he is my chosen one. Listen to him. So the question it asks us is, will we listen to him? And there are some Luke's Gospels at the back over there, and you're very welcome to take one away if you've never read it before, to do some listening to this chosen one. But Jesus is also relevant now and forever. The last point down there. And he said to all of them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. Jesus is relevant today because of his teaching here about denying ourselves, of not putting ourselves first, of being selfless in serving others, just like he did by dying and rising again. That was not for himself, but for us. To be saved. Jesus sets that pattern. If only our leaders were a little bit more selfless, we might trust them a little bit more, whether in this country or across the Atlantic. But if only our relationships too, if we were more selfless, how relevant would that be in helping people to get along much better? Jesus' teaching here is absolutely relevant. But more than that, it's relevant forever. Jesus at the end there says, whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and the holy angels. On that last day when all of us have to appear before God, he asks us, what have you done with Jesus? Have you listened to him? Have you been ashamed of him and his words? Or have you sought to honour him as the Son, the King, the global ruler and rescuer? So again, we need to ask ourselves what we think of Jesus. But at the end of time, it will be more about what does Jesus think of us? Have we been ashamed of him? Thank you very much for listening. I think there's probably a chance for Q&A. Matt, do you want to say what's happening next?